Yo, this is Fred, the Hammer Williamson. If you're listening to Chunk Food Cinema with Brian and Cargill on Film School Rejects. You know what I'm saying? So keep on listening. You just might learn something later.
We have done it. We have reached the point of scientific advancement that allows us to actually transform Film School Reject's 38th most popular column into a podcast, providing the public with an audible record of its harmful effects. I am Brian Salisbury, your resident junk man. I was the author of the column and am now the architect of this nightmare. And if you're a connoisseur of the geekier side of the internet, then you already know my co-host. He was a film critic for Ain't It Cool News for many years, writing under the pseudonym of Massaworm. We definitely need to talk about that one later. He is one of the writers of the horror film Sinister and the upcoming Deus Ex film adaptation. He is a published author with his second novel, Queen of the Dark Things, hitting shelves. When is that hitting shelves?
May.
In May. Junkies and Junkettes, my co-host, my good friend, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hey.
This is the thing we're doing.
This is a thing. It's a thing. No, I actually, you know, I was a film critic for just over a decade, and I've missed doing anything film related. But yeah. It's really hard to justify working in Hollywood and, you know, reviewing at the same time and being a critic. And it's something that I felt I wouldn't be able to do. And now that I'm deep in it, I couldn't imagine doing it. It just the honesty and just brutality that you need to be a good critic sometimes, you can't really wield while you're, you know, working in that industry, because essentially you're throwing elbows at your friends.
Yeah. It's hard to maintain objectivity if nothing else. And like you said, I mean, you don't want to poison any wells.
And perceived objectivity, which is the big thing, which is because you're throwing elbows at friends, you've got this notion that people might think that you're softening it up. They might think that you're, you know, helping people out. They might think that you're bad-mouthing one movie to support another movie. So just the very fact of being in those two worlds just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to figure out for a while how to get back talking about movies, because, you know, it's kind of my thing. It's what you and I sit around and do drinking coffee at 2 a.m.
So you decided the best way to avoid all that is to talk about Battle Truck for like 30 episodes.
For 30 episodes of Battle Truck, which is what this is. What Junk Food Cinema really is now a 30-part series on the brilliance of Battle Truck.
Yeah.
Which actually we will talk about Battle Truck at some point.
Yeah.
And Battle Truck spurned this, but we'll get to that soon. No, the thing is that I do get to now, I can talk about, you know, 20, 30, 40-year-old films, you know, that made me the writer that I am, and that made you the writer that you are, and that we love.
Yeah.
And the stuff that we embrace that isn't ordinarily embraced or talked about in most mainstream columns or mainstream cinema talk.
Yeah, I mean, this is the very first – I've been racking my brain for a way to bring Junk Food Cinema back, because – with launching my own site with oneofus.net, I've just been so consumed with everything I've been doing over there that I haven't had time to give the appropriate amount of thought and preparation into the writing of each of the column each and every week. But I've been racking my brain for a way to bring it back, because this was my very first column, and it was the one that I loved the most, and I kind of feel is the one that has my most personal stamp on it. So this is an introductory episode, the first bite, if you will, and we thought, you know, before we dive into the meatier discussions, we'd let you, the listener, get to know the two jokers at this table. So I'll eat up all the Haagen-Dazs you got on your shelf, but first, let me introduce myself. Junk Food Cinema was a column I launched in 2009. It was a celebration of the schlockiest, the cheesiest of cult and exploitation movies that I absolutely loved, and I would pair each film with a snack food, because much like junk food, I recognized that, you know, these films had shortcomings. There were things that made them quote-unquote bad, but I still thoroughly enjoyed consuming them. And that's kind of where this started, and I did that for a number of years, and then it evolved into sort of a weird, almost experimental phase where I was challenging myself to do different things, like, hey, instead of watching The Happening, let's listen to The Happening and see if it works as a radio play and just bizarre things like that. But it's been dormant for a while, so I can't, you know, as Cargill mentioned, we've been doing this for a while, just watching bad movies and loving, you know, the forgotten, I think you called them the forgotten children of cinema.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, well, that's, the thing is this is the type of thing that brought Austin together to begin with.
True.
You know, the Austin film scene, kind of where it is now really came together with, two major entities, Ain't It Cool News and, the Alamo Drafthouse. And, Harry and Tim became, very good friends. Harry Knowles and founder of Ain't It Cool News, and Tim League, founder of the Alamo Drafthouse. And they became friends and started doing lots of stuff together. And the various groups of people all started hanging out at the Drafthouse watching these weird movies. You know, the Drafthouse first started out as a second run house where, they, you know, you could go and watch a second run movie, that was, you know, something that was still in theaters. I remember the first movie I saw there with my wife was, Shakespeare in Love 2 months after it came out. You could have a dinner, you know, a meal and have a drink. And on Thursday nights, they would, at midnight, they would show an old repertory film. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first one my wife went to is she went and saw, Dark Crystal. And,
oh, yeah.
And saw Print of the Dark Crystal.
Oh yeah. Skeksis. Looks like Gelfling, smells like Gelfling, must be Gelfling.
Mm, delicious and, Gelfling.
Yeah, and so that was kind of the start of, you know, them showing those weird midnight movies became the start of the creation of the local community. And then what happened is they started showing more and more of that, and suddenly a whole community built around it. And Tim went out and bought up the like 250 films from the stock of an old closed up drive-in theater. Mm-hmm. And they needed to run through it, and they needed an excuse to run through it. So they started up this thing called Weird Wednesday. And Weird Wednesday, he would just run a film that they knew wasn't vinegary, you know, that didn't have that smell to it, that it was ruined, but that they didn't know if it was entirely complete, and they didn't know what shape it was in, and they didn't know how good the movie was oftentimes, but they would show it. And it was free. And so a bunch of us started showing up on Wednesday nights to watch these just weird, random movies that sometimes were really amazing and sometimes were spectacularly awful. Mm-hmm. Like really, really terrible stuff that nobody's heard of before. And we started getting to know each other. We started getting into chat rooms together. And all of a sudden,
asking for various age, sex, and locations of each other.
And the next thing you know, we're all hanging out together. And here we are, you know, like, we're over 15 years down the road. And an entire community has sprung up around this love of discovering, old cinema, especially neglected cinema.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, that community is the very reason that I live here. I mean, that community is what attracted me. And Cargill, you were actually there sort of at the genesis of my interest in B-movies. I had just moved to Austin in 2008. My first visit to Austin was in 2007, sort of a pre-bachelor party. Bachelor party was to go to Fantastic Fest 3. And it was during that Fantastic Fest that my buddy Luke Mullen and I, who also writes for Film School Rejects, made that decision. Like, this is the place where we should live. This is the epicenter of everything that is film geeky, and this is where we want to be. And so I just moved here entirely for the purpose of being nearer to the Alamo and that immersive, all-encompassing film appreciation scene that you mentioned. And you were kind of there to foster that love in the best way I could possibly imagine, by introducing me to 80s Italian post-apocalyptic knockoff movies.
That was a crazy night. We have this festival here in town called Fantastic Fest, and that was the one you went to, the third one, and that was kind of the genesis of a group that we all hang out with now.
Yeah.
In which a bunch of us who stood outside the theater and talked all exchanged information and decided to start hanging out regularly and getting together once every few weeks to watch a bunch of movies together. And we called it the Fantastic Film Appreciation Group. And
I'll leave you to come up with the abbreviation there.
And so we would get together and watch movies, and everyone would kind of bring movies, and we would decide what to watch then. And I had programmed the first one where it was exclusively programmed. I was like, I had talked to a bunch of you guys and realized that most of you had not seen either the original Death Race 2000 or Death Race, and the modern classic, which actually I love the hell out of.
Yeah,
and,
no, absolutely.
And I was like, I'm going to show these back to back. So we showed Death Race 2000, we showed Death Race, and most everybody left. But I had saved another movie for midnight for anyone who stuck around, and I saved it as a midnight movie, and I saved After the Fall of New York, which no one had seen, and I had on video, and I, you know, adore for all of its flaws.
Yeah.
And it just melted your brain. And I remember you looked at me and you're like, what the hell is this? Why is this movie this way? And yeah. I'm like, have you never seen Italian knockoff cinema? And you're like, what is that?
It's this weird phenomena of the Italians standing in defiance of copyright laws and making bargain basement ripoffs of whatever sci-fi flicks, usually post-apocalyptic, were popular in the States. So when we had Escape from New York over here, they made After the Fall of New York. When we had The Warriors, they made 1990 Bronx Warriors. And The Warriors isn't even a post-apocalyptic film, but it was just cheaper for them to make post-apocalyptic films because it's just all you need as a setting is a burnout building. Well, we can find a building that's been burned down and suddenly, oh no, that's, and they would always come up with the most insane and elaborate and ridiculous explanations for how the world ended. I think my favorite is in Warrior of the Lost World, in which, you know, they're scrolling through the text like it's Star Wars, except every line ends in 3 exclamation points for no reason whatsoever.
Well, that's the great thing about that entire era in particular is that the knockoffs became mashups.
Yeah.
And the mashups, you would just see, like, in After the Fall of New York, they cross, like, Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
With Escape from New York, with a revenge film, and there's little bits of sci-fi thrown in there that are just bizarre, and nothing really gels together like they intended, and instead it becomes awesome in its own special way.
In a very prescient way, Children of Men is works its way in there, because you have the whole concept of they're going in there to find the last fertile female, and it's just like, I'm sorry, what?
Well, Children of Men is really just a remake of After the Fall.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say without saying it, without being libelous at all. That's where I'm getting at.
And some of them are good in their own right, which is what's so fantastic, is there are those gems that are just, there are moments that are great, which leads us into what the idea of this show is. I mean, this was you and I sitting around talking about some of these films one
night.
As we often do. Yeah. And there was scotch involved. I remember that.
Yep.
And at one point you're like, you know, it would be really cool if we did this, you know, kind of like I used to do with Junk Food Cinema. And I was like, oh, hell yes. Let's sit around once a week and talk about a different topic of these movies, these gems that we particularly are in love with in some way, shape, or form.
And it was one of those things that I had the idea to do Junk Food Cinema as a podcast, but I knew that the success of this show would hinge on finding the right co-host. And I didn't even think to ask you. In fact, I think the sentence that I said to you was, I really wish you weren't so busy because I would love for you to be the co-host of the Junk Food Cinema podcast. And you looked at me and like, I'm not too busy to be the co-host of the Junk Food Cinema podcast. And here we are.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, can I set aside an hour or two a week to sit down and talk about movies? Oh, I think I can find that. I've been really busy. I've been very, very fortunate and very blessed in the various opportunities that will come my way. But I'll wake up early on a Saturday and come over here and slug some coffee and drink some scotch and talk about Battle Truck. Well, it was Battle Truck that tipped this off.
Yeah, it really was.
We will probably reference Battle Truck quite a bit.
Definitely. But, you know, and I love that this is how we're beginning the conversation, because it was not only the genesis of because what happened was, after watching After the Fall of New York, was that I would go to the local video stores here, Vulcan and I Love, and track down all the other ones. Exterminators of the Year 3000 and 1990 Bronx Warriors and Warrior of the Lost World and the New Barbarians. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. So I watched all those and then I kind of moved on to other things and, oh, what's this? And I want to check this out. And so it just, you know, it was sort of the gateway drug, I guess. And it was something that I wanted to see more of these lost films. I wanted to see more of these films that people really didn't talk about anymore, that were, for one reason or another, kind of relegated to the back shelves. And this city has really afforded me the opportunity to do that. So I feel very fortunate in that way. And that's where the column came from. And that's why the very first entry into Junk Food Cinema is 1990 Bronx Warriors. Like, that's not an accident. That is very, very deliberate. And
we were talking about that and how that came to be and how that affected you. Was that also originated at Fantastic Fest, where one of the years they were doing a retrospective on post-apocalyptic films. And they had 4 like really good lost ones. You know, I remember Miracle Mile was one of them. And I'm blanking on the title of several of the other ones. they decided to have a fun one, and that was 1990 Bronx Warriors.
Yeah.
And that's where a bunch of us saw it on 35 millimeter. Is just, you know, it was in an off slot where I'd already seen everything else playing, and I was like, well, I'll check this out. And it's just so much fun. And then, of course, you know, several of the people that work at Vulcan and work at I Love Video here in town, too, you know, long running video stores here in town that survived the wipeout, because this is Austin, and
yeah,
and they've done very well. And most of the people we know have at some point worked at one or the other. I worked at I Love Video for a spell, and most of our friends work at Vulcan, or have worked at Vulcan. But so they went from seeing that and made sure to stock it at Vulcan and put it forward and like, you got to see this movie. And sure enough, they're, you know, that's where you walk in and say, I'm looking for a great post-apocalyptic film. And they're like, here, have 1990 Bronx Warrior. And that's really how everything just kind of gets passed around in Austin. It's always been that way. I mean, ever since the dawn of this community, you know, someone would discover something. And, I mean, I really miss Pedazzo Chunk, which Harry Knowles' sister, Danny Knowles, used to run, and before you guys got here, I was never
fortunate enough to go to Pedazzo Chunk,
and it was really a pass around place. Like, they ran that, but what would happen is other people in town that would hang out there would find something. Like, I remember when Nightwatch came out, and somebody in Russia,
right,
and somebody showed up with a DVD of Nightwatch and handed it to me and said, dude, you got to watch this movie.
It's like the video store version of tape trading.
Yeah, no, it really was, and we discovered like stuff a year, two, 3 years before it would come to the States. You know, I remember Ong Bak Muay Thai Warrior was passed around a lot. And that's how I remember it, is as Ong Bak Muay Thai Warrior, not Ong Bak. As it was eventually released here. But it was released here after they went and completely redid all the sound for it. So so we had already watched this movie four or five times when it showed up at Butnumathon as a recut movie for the States. And we're like, oh, this is different. This is kind of weird. But yeah, it was very much, you know, exposing each other to this really weird, awesome genre of cinema that was mostly neglected and kind of hard to find.
Yeah.
And that now the internet has totally, you know, just kind of broken wide open and given you access to a bunch of stuff. It's like, you can't find Battle Truck anywhere, but it's on YouTube.
Yeah. And hitting this right at the height of its popularity, we're starting this podcast now. So, I mean, that's kind of who we are and what this show will be about. I mean, there's going to be a lot of different types of discussions. We're going to have discussions about specific actors, specific movies. You know, we may have, you know, make games out of it. This may take on a lot of really bizarre forms, and I'm really happy to see what happens and how this evolves. But the one thing you can always count on is that these are the movies that we love. These are the movies that most people have forgotten, and we're just kind of here to wax geeky about them. And we will incorporate junk food into the film discussion in various fashions, but that fashion will likely change week to week, much like our diets do. So
yeah, today we're on the coffee and scotch diet. Today's junk food is J&B on ice.
Delicious. So with that, we should toast to the birth of Junk Food Cinema, the podcast,
to the first junk food, and hopefully not the last. Junk Food Cinema episode.
Please don't cancel us yet, Neil.
Welcome to Junk Food Cinema. Can I take your order? Our special today is diabetes.
Well, we are now appropriately liquored up and ready to, are you ready for this? Prattle beyond the stars. Huh? See what I did there?
No.
You don't like that?
No, I don't.
Well, I don't have a second take, so we're pretty much going to have to use that one. I don't know what to tell you, man. That's right. The first film to be featured in discussion in this JFC 2.0 is also a movie that we share a lot of fondness for.
A lot of fondness.
Maybe a little too much fondness, but
not at all. No,
the exact right amount of fondness.
No, this is, I think Battle Beyond the Stars is the perfect example of what we want to do with Junk Food Cinema and who we are as film lovers.
Yeah.
It is a film that has such an amazing history to it and is such a centerpiece of film history that very few people really know about or fully understand. So a lot of people are aware of it. A lot of people my age remember it after you talk to them for 2 minutes, because you'll tell them, oh, have you ever seen this? They're like, Battle Beyond the Stars, what the hell is that? You explain it to them and then they're like, wait, I think I saw this movie on cable or something. It's like, yeah.
When you did.
When we were kids, it was one of those movies that that played on HBO a lot and then was eventually picked up by a bunch of the, you know, the old UHF and high VHF stations when, you know, the local stations, when they would lack programming, they would have hour blocks of movies and they would show whatever movies they could get for cheap.
Right.
And Corman movies were always available for cheap. And this was one of those – it was one of the bigger budget Corman films. So it played on television all the time. One of my friends, when he found out how much I love this movie, he was working at a small TV station in Iowa. And so he went in and found out that they had the rights to show it. And he burned through in like a month and a half all of their you pay a certain amount and then you get to show that movie X number of times, and he maxed out the number of times he was allowed to show it because he kept putting it on in slots. Because they,
I just imagine him doing it like the Christmas Story on TBS, the Christmas Eve, just like for 24 hours, nothing but Battle Beyond the Stars.
It was like every weekend he put on Battle Beyond the Stars. He was trying to rekindle interest in Iowa. And I hope out there in Iowa there's some folks who are like, oh man, I don't know why they were doing it, but it was so cool. That movie's great.
There's like a great Herschel Gordon Lewis quote about, you know, we put it on in Iowa because I figured if we died in Iowa, who would know? Now, Battle Beyond the Stars is actually an interesting chapter in the story of our friendship, even, because the first time I ever met you was at Fantastic Fest in 2007, and I remember like the story that my buddy Luke and I would talk about, you know, driving home from that festival, was that guy that we met who was holding court on Tim League's front porch about Little Jimmy Cameron and Battle Beyond the Stars. And it's something that has stuck with me that I always remember. So it's funny that this is not only the first movie that we talk about, you know, in discussion here in Junk Food Cinema 2.0, but also, you know, the first movie that ended up being featured in the column back in 2009. So
now, did you see it for the first time after you heard me talking about it, or had you already seen it?
I saw it for the first time after I heard you talking about it. I had been raised on a few other Corman titles, specifically Death Race 2000, which is one that, yes, my grandmother recommended to me of all people. But I hadn't seen Battle Beyond the Stars. So when I heard that a big part of its lineage was the fact that James Cameron, it was one of his first jobs, I was like, okay, well, I got to seek this out. And luckily, the Baton Rouge Public Library, where I was living at the time, had a copy. I was flabbergasted that they actually had a copy of Battle Beyond the Stars. But I popped it in and I watched it and I was like, oh, this is fantastic. I love the fact that I am watching Seven Samurai in space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a movie that, you know, you mentioned Little Jimmy Cameron, and we'll get into that here very shortly.
Definitely.
But no, it's a movie that it's one of Corman's greatest assets was he could recognize young talent.
Definitely.
And he would give everybody a shot. He'd give everybody a couple shots. And the guy's made 300 films. So, you know, a lot of that didn't take off. But the people that did – you know, the most famous story is, you know, he cast this young actor that he really liked in this one little role in Little Shop of Horrors and just gave him a, you know.
Jeff Nicholson,
I think? Something like that.
John Nicholson.
John Nicky, Jack Nicholson,
something to that effect.
Whoever it was, you know, a guy who would end up becoming Leonardo DiCaprio or the Leo DiCaprio of his time.
Look, Paul Harvey, let's not change the script at the end just so that we know the rest of the story. Let's keep on track here. But, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. That is always one of the things that I have admired most about Corman was his ability to launch. I mean, the people that worked for him didn't always have the nicest things to say about him while they were working for him. But nobody could deny the fact that a lot of careers were launched by Roger Corman. And in fact, they came to refer to it as the class of Corman or the school of Corman. And one of the things I found out doing a little bit of research on Battle Beyond the Stars is that at the time of its production, there was actually an incredibly contentious relationship between quote-unquote film school kids and those young upstarts who had chosen to begin their careers by working for Corman. It's kind of analogous to the predicament facing many high school graduates. It was like, do I join the workforce immediately in a blue-collar environment, or do I go to college to get training for a quote-unquote more respectable job? I mean, that's what was going on.
Yeah.
And it's something I never thought about, but like, not only was Roger Corman recruiting all these people and providing jobs for all these upstarts, but he was actually kind of bucking the film school system and creating a division.
Yeah. Yeah. And it churned out a lot of really interesting genre filmmakers and filmmakers that would go on to do non-genre stuff after the fact. And this is one of those collections, and this I hold to be the finest collection of young talent of any Corman film. Like, quite literally, he had such an amazing young crew. I mean, right down to his producer's assistant, his production assistant, went on to do amazing things. And everybody but the director, you know, the director of the film is the one person where you're like, who's the director? Oh, yeah, you've never seen anything.
Let's be fair. The director of this movie was Roger Corman. I mean, somebody else's name is on it, but the director of this film was Roger Corman.
I don't know how much of that is actually true. I'm curious, but I've never – it's one of those things. It's even to this day like Poltergeist, you know, where you get three
different
answers.
How much did Toby Hooper actually direct?
Yeah, and you get different answers depending on who you ask. And Toby Hooper's like, it's not my film. And Steven Spielberg like, no, it's absolutely Toby's film. It's not mine. And everybody's like, but it looks like your film. And
one of those ladies is protesting too much. We just don't know which one it is.
Yeah, but – but yeah, so here, you know, the only person whose work you don't really know is the director. Everyone else, you're familiar with in a way. So
Roger Corman, household name. James Cameron, household name. Jimmy T. Murakami, not necessarily a household name.
Not so much. And we keep mentioning Cameron, and Cameron has a very small but very important role in this film. So for those of you that aren't familiar with the movie, essentially at one point, Roger Corman – you know, Star Wars was huge. He wanted his Star Wars. He didn't want to make it for real money, but it was the most expensive production he'd ever done at the time. It was a $2 million movie. And he wanted to take $2 million and make a sci-fi film. And he'd made a couple others, and they like Star Crash, and they hadn't really totally caught on. But he wanted to make his epic.
And much in true Corman style, it was actually a $2.5 million movie, but he was determined to make it for $2 million. Anywhere he could shave off costs, that's what he was looking for.
Yeah. And so someone had pitched him the idea, and I'm not sure exactly who had the idea. But the idea was, let's remake The Seven Samurai and set it in space.
Yeah.
And so what they did is they brought on a young screenwriter who is just fresh working for them, a guy named John Sayles.
Oh, John Sayles.
John Sayles, who we will do an episode here
entirely upon the work of John Sayles.
On specifically his genre work, because his early genre work is just so amazing and so daring and brilliant. And this is one of those examples. Here you give this guy who really understands film and film history, and who's trying to work his way up, is hired to write what is ostensibly a shit movie, which is just science fiction, and his only you know beacon to go by is just make The Seven Samurai in space. So he wrote the best goddamn Seven Samurai in space movie he could, and that's what he did.
He turned in a 160-page script for Make the Seven Samurai in Space. That's what I love about John Sayles. He's given a shit assignment, but doesn't half-ass it. Who the hell, if all you're given is that log line, who the hell would turn in a 160-page script?
I want to find that draft.
Yeah.
That's one of my dreams, is to get a copy of the John Sayles draft of Battle Beyond the Stars, because I want to see what's missing. I want to see what's not there.
You know that there's stuff that's been cut out of that. There's, I mean, not only the fact that a 160-page script does not end up, you know, on this, every page is not ending up on the screen. That's just math. But also, if you look at the plot structure of Battle Beyond the Stars, there's sort of a rush through at the beginning to get from planet to planet to recruit all the mercenaries before they get into the final battle. So my theory is that the stuff that's missing is all in those first couple acts, all getting from planet to planet and really digging into who these characters are, who these strange beings are in the world that they live in. I feel like they kind of breeze through that in the first act. I feel like that's where the fat had to have been trimmed.
Possibly, but you never know with Sayles.
You never know.
Sayles is I honestly think a lot of it is probably cowboy. He loves cowboy more than any other character in that movie. And it's a character named Cowboy, who everybody refers to as Space Cowboy. And he's referred to as both in the film. And but the movie titles list him as Cowboy, but he's Space Cowboy.
He is the film's duly appointed representative for Earth, and it's not only he's not only American, not only is America representing all of Earth like it's an episode of Futurama, but he is an American cowboy. So do you talk about the iconography of that? Like, you are the representative of Earth in this entire film, and you are an American cowboy.
And he was – they really set him up to be the Han Solo.
Definitely.
But he's – actually cooler than Han Solo.
He's got a scotch and soda belt.
Yes, he does.
He has a scotch and soda belt.
He does. He has a sci-fi belt that has scotch, soda, and ice.
Yeah.
And leads to one of the finest moments of writing that I have ever seen. It's one of my favorite moments in film. It's this moment where now Space Cowboy is played by George Peppard. And this was in this era before George Peppard made his comeback. He was, you know, an actor who had never really caught on. He'd done a lot of stuff when he was younger. Of course, Breakfast at Tiffany's is his pinnacle work. He had not yet signed on to do the A-Team. And so he didn't have the big career resurgence. But he puts his all into this thing. And there's this scene where he is screwed. He's on a planet. He's like, all right, guys, I did what you asked me to. I'm going to take off now. They're like, you can't leave the planet. You know, the range on that beacon is 3 made up words from here. and he'll, you know, Sator will shoot you out of the sky. And there's this look on his face. And then he goes and he pulls out his glass and puts scotch in there. And the woman's like, you forgot the ice and the soda. The ice in the water. He goes, no, I didn't. And just and slams it in such a way. And you're just, it's like, it's the perfect representation of this character and just who he is in that moment. And it's like, oh yeah. No. And so then you realize that from that point on, while he's fighting through the rest of the movie, he's drunk.
Yeah. And it's a very easy moment for guys like us to appreciate. And not only that, but I do expect one of those for Christmas now, Cargill. I don't mean to put a lot of pressure on you, but there should be a scotch and soda belt under my tree, or, you know, maybe
there should be a scotch and soda belt, but I don't think they exist. And if they did, they probably wouldn't work right.
Get on that, internet. This is something that we need as a society.
If it were feasible to make a scotch and soda belt, I am convinced that it would already be in the Sky Mall. I mean, I'd imagine that there would be guys walking around through the airport, you know, with their scotch and soda belt. Like, what's that? You forgot the soda in the water, you know, the ice in the water. No, I didn't. But no, there isn't. So we've got this. We've got John Sayles. He's written this script, and they're going to make this movie, and they hire a cast of what is, you know, a few of the Corman staples at the time. They're young, up and coming star. They need a Mark Hamill, so they get.
Oh,
Richard Thomas.
Richard Thomas, yeah.
John definitely. Boy, who is trying to make a leap from being, you know, John Boy on the Waltons to major film work. But, of course, no one was really buying into it.
You know, what's hilarious about this is I've been watching The Americans on FX and just now put together that one of the characters on The Americans is John Boy, is our hero from Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, yeah.
Zoomed right past me because he's been off the radar for so long.
Yeah.
Crazy.
But so everyone else they filled it out with were a couple of Corman regulars and then some, you know, actors who were just kind of falling off the radar. And so we have George Peppard. We have Robert Vaughn reprising his role from The Magnificent Seven.
He's the only person in this movie who has actually already done a Seven Samurai remake in the past.
And the one of the best remakes of all time,
definitely.
Magnificent Seven. And so he's playing the exact same character, just named differently. And now he's Geld, which again, that's John Sayles. It's, you know, John Sayles throwing in a little, it's a guy who's had his balls clipped off.
Right.
And is just kind of bitter and wants to hide. And, it has the saddest moment in the film, but we'll talk about that in a little bit because I'm curious. You and I have never talked about our feelings on the burial of Geld, and that's a weird scene, and it's a really cool scene in its own way. But we'll get to that. But so they're making this film, and Corman is starting to get pissed because Corman is a guy who makes movies in 7 days, and he wanted to
remake Seven Samurai in 7 days.
Well, I don't know if he wanted to make this one. He knew this one was going to take time, but many of his films were made in a week. Little Shop of Horrors, they made in a weekend.
Yeah,
you know, that classic film, a weekend they shot that movie. And so the special effects team is taking forever. And they're not getting anything done. They're in pre-production. Things aren't getting prepared. And he gets furious. He's like, Gale, I want you to go down there and figure this out. Find out what's going on.
Yeah.
So he tasks his production assistant, Gail Ann Hurd, a woman that you might know as producer on such things as The Incredible Hulk, The Terminator, The Abyss, Aliens, The Walking Dead. You know, she's done a couple small little things
little
you
movies.
May have
Indies.
Heard of.
Indies.
She's one of the most powerful women women in Hollywood, and she's incredibly talented and just this uber producer who is married to James Cameron as a result of this movie. So she goes down to wherever they're doing the special effects to find out. And she spends some time down there and comes back and goes, okay, I found out what the problem is. And Corman's like, what is it? What's the problem? And he's like, well, you hired a bunch of people from Industrial Light and Magic. And he's like, yeah. He's like, but you didn't hire John Dykstra. You hired all the guys who used to get John Dykstra coffee and make his copies.
Yeah.
They worked there. They don't know what they're doing. And he gets furious. He's like, fire them. Fire them all. I want everyone gone. Fire them. And she's like, no. There's one kid down there. His name's Jimmy. He's a model painter. He's doing just an amazing, wonderful job. And he's like, fine, whatever. They fire everyone but Jimmy. This Jimmy guy, he's the art director now. Make him the art director.
Yeah.
And that's how James Cameron got his first big
And game. It's funny to me that – not only with Gale, but also the rest of the crew kind of unanimously voting, like, you know, James, you should be our production designer, our art director. And what's funny about that to me is the relationship on set between James Cameron's department and some of the other art departments was not very amiable. Like, he would apparently would borrow tools from them and just take them and, like, use them in any way he saw fit to get the shot and then return them broken. And so they kind of hated each other, like his department and the other department. But when push came to shove, I mean, the thing you have to remember is this movie was due out in July of 1980, and by January, nothing had been done. January of 1980 rolls around, there is nothing done on this movie. So for Corman, who, like you said, usually makes movies really quickly, is starting to get nervous because of all the money behind it. And I think that may have been what influenced him when Gale Hurd comes into his office and says, no, there's one guy for him to, like, not even listen to the rest of the sentence. Like, fine, head of production designer now. Go, just get something done.
Yeah, and so and Cameron came in and did an amazing job, and he designed the infamous boob ship that as people refer to it. He did it exactly that people are like, that ship's got boobs, and yeah, it's like, yeah,
that was his point.
It looks like fallopian tubes. That was it. He up until that point, ships had been phallic as hell, and he's like, I wanted to make a feminine ship,
and it was the first ship in any movie that had, even though the ship in Alien was called Mother, it was the first ship in any movie that had a female voice. So Cameron kind of took that and ran with it, and that led to the design of a ship that, yeah, it looks like fallopian tubes. Yes, it has tits. That's the entire point. It looks like the torso of a woman.
Yeah.
Because it has a woman's voice.
Yeah. And it's and that ship is cool.
It really is. I mean, all the ships in that movie are cool because they're all – and apparently, you know, we hear stories about on Battle Beyond the Stars, them like fishing old aquariums out of the trash that were like half melted and using that, incorporating that in it. And when you hear that, you think, oh, they must look really shitty. But actually, the ships in this movie, there's a method to the madness of the bizarre ship designs in this film. Basically, the effects artists always felt that the ships in Star Wars looked like they were all designed at the same factory. Even though they came from different planets, from different alien races, they all looked like they could have been built at the same factory. So what they were trying to do was to give more individual personality to ships from different quadrants of the galaxy. And I think that's really cool. I think that's, you know, it's a whether it's a creative mission statement or just a smokescreen for budgetary slapdashery, I love the idea that a movie that owes its existence to Star Wars is also somehow fighting to differentiate itself from Star Wars at the same time.
Well, and that's ultimately at the end of the day, this is what's so great about this movie and why I feel so strongly about it. Is it's a film that on a base level, it's just a knockoff mashup, which we happen to love knockoff mashups.
Sure.
You know, our the next film we're going to talk about is a knockoff mashup as well. But it is, it's Seven Samurai meets Star Wars. But you put this young, talented screenwriter on it. You put this young, talented production designer on it. And art director on it. And what you end up getting is something that we've never seen before and never totally seen again. All of the aliens feel different, you know, from the design to their philosophies to just how they fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this really cool collection of all these oddball ideas and characters that really does feel like pulp sci-fi, and pulp sci-fi in the way that it felt in the 50s and 60s in the written pulp sci-fi. And no other movie has really totally captured that. You know, you have weird races like the Kelvins that speak entirely in heat and in variations of energy. And you've got, you know, the alien from the Lambda Zone who runs around poaching weird kind of space whales and energy
it's
things.
Like some weird energy space worm that can eat things, but he poaches them to eat them.
And he finds a woman. And he's like, oh man, this is gonna be great. I can get so much money for you. And then but he is the last of his species, which was wiped out by Sador. And so he's like, oh, fuck this. We're gonna go and take this guy out. You've got, you know, space cowboy who's kind of laid back and a little cowardly, but just full and brimming with personality and comedy. You've got Nestor, which is this unimind alien race that all experiences all the same things all at once. They're just facets of one brain. I mean, every single race and ship feels completely, totally different. And so I don't know if it's so much slapdashery trying to hide it or if it was very much, you know, what this movie has always felt like to me is a bunch of young, talented guys trying to prove themselves and in something that everyone else ostensibly doesn't give a shit about. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately doing it, because James Cameron, he would, you know, be tasked to shoot the inside of a ship, and he'd grab a bunch of egg crates and spray paint them, you know, silver and put some Christmas lights up. And it sounds like it's terrible, but until you hear that description, you don't realize that's exactly what those rooms are. And you look at it, it's like, holy crap, that really is fucking egg crates and Christmas lights. But it looks so cool the way James Cameron wired it all together. It looks really neat. It's like, I want to recreate the inside of that ship. The colors they chose work, the designs of the ship, the makeup work on the aliens, all great. And tying this whole thing together is the second score by a young composer by the name of James
Horner. Yeah.
And this was the second film. He had just done another film for Corman named Humanoids from the Deep. And the score he wrote for this was so good, Horner himself would rip himself off twice more in toto for the movies Krull and then a little thing called Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Well, I mean, well, that's true. And it also ended up being in trailers for other Corman movies.
More than that, Corman actually, and this is where Corman is why part of the reason people hate Corman. Corman used that score in six other films. The way he had the rights written up for that, the score, he lifted it whole hog, as well as all the visual effects.
Yeah.
He put those visual effects in half a dozen films over 10 years.
Right. No, there's the movie Space Raiders, which is a Corman film, is actually just like extra footage. Like they basically took footage from the space battles and Battle Beyond the Stars and then just shot new interiors and sort of extra footage. But it is all of the space battle shots from Battle Beyond the Stars.
They repurposed all of that. And that movie's terrible.
No, it is. Like, it's that absolutely
movie,
terrible.
I have a poster for that film and a sick love for that film. And yet I never, ever recommend that movie because it's not good. In fact, everything about that movie is bad.
Well, listeners, I want to play for you, you know, since this is a score that has bounced around in all these different films and been sort of, you know, Horner's done sound-alikes for other movies. I'm going to play a little snippet of it right here just so you can hear it. So yeah, that's the score. And you know what's funny is we talk about this movie, Battle Beyond the Stars, being made on such a shoestring budget, and yet there is nothing cheap about that score.
No, in fact, it's really brilliant to hear. You know, it's one of those scores that even Corman to this day is just madly in love with, because Horner was, you know, again trying to prove himself, and he wrote a different theme for every character in the movie, and then during the space battles would weave those themes together. When those people were in the same shot together. So like the famous one is where, three ships kind of come up out from behind an asteroid in this triumphant moment. And the score is those three characters' themes woven together in this big explosive ba 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 da ba da ba da da ba ba ba. I mean, it's just it's so good. No, there's nothing. Everyone on this film is trying. The actors are trying. You know, they're giving it their all. You know, Sale's script is really trying very hard to be smart and sly. He's got little jokes in there. They're from, you know, it's a Seven Samurai knockoff, and they're from the planet Akir.
Yeah,
and
that's a good one. Well, and what's interesting about that too is he's not just weaving in, you know, stuff from Star Wars. He's not just weaving in stuff from Seven Samurai. There are references to Isaac Asimov in the script. There are references to Greek mythology. Okay, so the first guy that our hero has to go see is a weapons maker by the name of, and I'm not making this up, Dr. Hephaestus, which, if you know your Greek mythology, is the Greek god of blacksmith's fire.
Yeah. Like, he's also known as Vulcan.
Yeah. Like that, come on. Like, that is not an accident.
No, not at all. No. And that's the thing, is that's John Sayles being John Sayles. And the entire script is filled with those moments.
Yeah.
And it's just so smart, even though it has no, there was no intention for it to be that, you know, they weren't trying to make a smart film. They were trying to make a knockoff that would make money. And they ended up, you know, Corman just ended up with this crew of people that gave a shit.
Yeah. That's...
So the movie is, you know, you show it to people and they laugh at some of the makeup and they laugh at some of the designs and they're like, this is silly. But if they get to the end of the movie, they're like, wow, that's really good. How did I not know this movie existed? It's like, 'cause it's just one of those movies that fell by the wayside.
And it's unfortunate that it did. But I mean, just to go back for a second to give you an idea of the conditions under which this movie was forged, the movie's crew, by and large, was acquired through trickery. Which is such a great Corman story. So the studio at which he shot this movie used to be a lumberyard. And when he bought the movie, or when he bought the studio, or when he bought this property, it was a lumberyard, and they were going to take the sign down and put up something that basically indicated it was now a studio. And Corman said, and this is a terrible Corman, but no, leave it up, because if people see that it is a movie studio, they will be more likely to rob it. So he left it up as a lumberyard. Well, you had carpenters from all around the area coming to this place to try and buy lumber, and he would hire them on the spot. So it was like this trap that he set. See, these carpenters coming in trying to buy lumber, and he's like, hey, we don't have any lumber, but you're a carpenter. How would you like a job? And that's – so he's basically like tricking these craftsmen to come to his lot and then hiring them as crew members. That's essential, exactly. Corman. Like, that is essential to understanding the type of filmmaker that Corman was. The type of shyster at times that he was.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. I really wish I could find this movie. There's this independent film shot here, going on nearly 15 years ago, called Attack of the Bat Monsters.
Oh yeah.
That I've talked to you about.
Yeah.
Where essentially it was this guy, I believe his name was Kelly Green. He directed a film that was all about the Corman era of filmmaking, and it wasn't specifically about Corman, but it was all cobbled together of all the stories of Corman. And sadly, it never saw release. It played the festival circuit. It was right during the era when indie film was exploding and everybody was looking to buy indie films. Corman heard about it because Joe Dante, another one of Corman's finds, saw the film at a festival and called up Roger. He's like, Roger, you have to see this movie. And Corman finally saw it and he's like, oh, I love it. I'll buy it. I'll buy it from you for $50,000. And Kelly Green was like, I think I can do better, and went around and spent 6 months trying to do better. And nobody was interested. And he goes back to Corman and he says, oh, hey, is that offer still available? And he's like, oh no, that was 6 months ago. I moved on. And so he looked the gift horse in the mouth, and that movie Corman would have put it out and pimped it, but it's got, it really, the reason why Corman loved it was he was like, this is exactly what it was like. You know, it was, you know, the producer going to, you know, the house of a writer who's got a drug habit and who needs money. And he's like, I know you need some money right now. I need, you know, my Attack of the Bat Monster script by Monday. And he's like, but it's Friday. And he's like, you know, do it. And so the writer hops himself up on Benzedrine and spends 2 days writing a script and delivers, you know, and the producer's trying to get it the whole time and gets him the script, and he's shooting on Monday, and they start running out of lights. So they circle all the cars around the area and turn on the headlights and use that as a lighting kit. And Corman's like, we did that. We actually did all that. And I feel like that is an essential part of who Corman is and how these came to be. And that's what's so magical about this film is, by all rights, this film shouldn't be as good as it is.
It really shouldn't.
But it is tremendously good. This is literally my favorite movie. Like, if I, you know, I don't think it is the best movie ever made, but when you talk about what's your favorite movie, this is it. I've seen this movie well over 100 times. I will watch this movie wherever and whenever I can.
I own this movie in 3 different formats.
Yeah.
And there's no reason that I should, like, once you get the Blu-ray, you should get rid of the DVD. Once you got the DVD, there's no reason to keep the VHS. But I can't bring myself to get rid of any of them.
No, it's and I can't because, you know, I worked so hard to track down Battle Beyond the Stars for years. Nobody knew this film existed, and you could never find it at video stores. And I spent 4 years trying to track it down until finally eBay came around and somebody was selling a copy on eBay. And I'm like, oh, fantastic. And while I was looking, I was like, oh, somebody's selling Krull as well. Fantastic. I need to get that too. And you know, this is really early days internet when it's like, oh my God, I can find all this rare stuff that I've been looking for years. And now, of course, now it's, you know, been in print and it goes in and out of print. And, you know, Corman's stuff doesn't stay in print very long, but Battle Beyond the Stars always sells out and then always becomes expensive.
Definitely.
I mean, every time Battle Beyond the Stars gets put out, it's just got this rabid fan base out there that loves the hell out of it. And if somehow you miss that window of getting it, you got to wait till the next format release or you're going to pay $250 for a Blu-ray. My wife tracked down the soundtrack for me for my birthday years ago. In fact, you weren't here at the time, but my 30th birthday was a Battle Beyond the Stars birthday.
Nice.
And there was my wife had a Battle Beyond the Stars cake made with all the faces replaced by the various bloggers here in Austin.
See, I would have gone full hardcore Battle Beyond the Stars nerd, and I would have come as the insect monster that's on the poster that's not actually in the film.
Yeah, well, that's because Corman had the poster made before. There's also a variant of that poster with a Wookiee on it. There's no Wookiee in the movie. In fact, it was funny. I had this party at Pedazzo Chunk, and we were there a few days before my birthday because there was an event here in town for a movie that was having its Austin premiere. We had already seen it at an advanced screening, but the director was bringing one of the actors from the movie, and everyone who had seen the movie was now a huge fan of this actor and this director, even though it was the first thing that they'd seen from everyone. The movie was Shaun of the Dead, so, you know, it's Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg was there, and somebody came up to me and said, "Oh, hey, I saw the picture of your Battle Beyond the Stars cake. I can't wait for the party." And Simon Pegg just looks at me and he goes, "Wait, am I correct in saying that you're having a Battle Beyond the Stars birthday party?" And I said, "Yeah, actually, I kind of am." And he's like, "I love that movie." And so, you know, he's like, and he told me this great story. He's like, you know, when you were in the schoolyard when you were a kid, you would pick out your movie and you'd stake out your movie early. And he's like, "That's the movie," and you defend that movie. And that's, you know, that you that's your movie because you called it. And he goes, "I called Battle Beyond the Stars before it came out, and I was convinced it was going to be the greatest movie ever. And so I was terrified as going in to see it because I thought, what would happen if this movie wasn't great?" And then it turned out being Battle Beyond the Stars, and I'm like, "It's amazing, isn't it?" He's like, "Oh my God." And so, you know, it's got its rabid fan base in nerddom that just loves the hell out of it. And I am one of those hardcore nerds. I'm so happy that it's been a movie that you and I have bonded over several times, because it really is just there's just something so great about everything about that movie. There isn't a single moment that I'm just like, "Oh man, this is..." You know, there's one moment where I'm like, "Well, maybe a little much," the hot dog moment. But there's the hot dog moment also has a lot of cool sci-fi going on.
Yeah, the fact that one of them chews and the rest of them are chewing as well. I always thought, like, that hive mind concept pushed to the nth degree.
Yeah, but of course, then it leads to one of the better lines in that thing, which is like, "There's no dog in this."
Yep, like, that's what we call meat on my planet.
That's what we call meat back home. Yeah, okay, so let me bring this up because there is. So essentially, for those of you who haven't seen it, the basic premise is it is the Seven Samurai in space. It's a planet is under attack by a Darth Vader like villain called Sador, who
it's played by the immortal John Saxon. The guy is in my top 10 of favorite actors of all time. I love the hell out of John Saxon.
Most of you would know John Saxon from
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Well, you might know him from Nightmare on Elm Street, but most people know him as the white guy, the white kung fu guy in
Enter the Dragon.
In Enter the Dragon.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And which is probably his best heroic role. Like playing the cop in Nightmare is a cool role, but he's never cooler than he is in Enter the Dragon.
No, that's
with Bruce
very
Lee.
True. No, he's very much cooler in that movie, but he did fall into a rut for a while. I don't know a rut necessarily, but he fell into a comfortable pattern of playing police officers in horror films. He did it in Nightmare on Elm Street. He did it in Black Christmas. He did it in a movie called Blood Beach, which I really like, yeah. Which is a weird Jaws ripoff where the monster isn't in the water. It's under the sand of the actual beach. So it's like Jaws meets Tremors before Tremors.
And one of his last roles was he did an episode of CSI.
Yeah.
Where
I think he's still alive, actually.
Yeah, but he's
not one of his most okay. I see
one
what you're saying.
One of his last
okay,
roles.
I got you.
Yeah, he hasn't acted since. But it was Quentin Tarantino's episode of CSI.
Oh, there you go.
And Tarantino brought him in as the villain, and it was because he's very he's advancing in years, and even in the Tarantino thing, which God has to be like a decade ago now.
Which is why we need to fight really hard to get him on this show, and soon. I'm just saying. I'm just throwing that out there.
You know what? I wouldn't – dude, the guy's fucking – he's awesome. So let's stop glowing about John Saxon right now and let's move on to trying to – we have to do a John Saxon episode.
Oh, totally.
We have to just talk about the best of Saxon.
Definitely.
But so he's – they attack this planet and the young farm boy gets sent out to get help because the interesting thing – and this is another thing that I loved about Sales was – the planet is a pacifist planet, and they have this very kind of Eastern philosophy.
Oh, it's essentially an ashram. Like, yeah. It's a weird, like, hippie community that they've built.
They're like, we can't fight, but they do have one guy who can go out and kind of break the rules, and they always choose a rebel, and the previous one was Zed the Corsair.
Zed the Corsair.
And, but Zed is blind now. He's been on too many crazy adventures, and so they sent, Zed sends the young farm boy out, and he goes to collect a bunch of mercenaries, to hire mercenaries to come back and protect the planet. And so what he ends up with is this weird collection of violent thugs and aliens and interesting species. And one of those is a guy named Gel that we already briefly talked about, played by
Robert Vaughn.
Robert Vaughn. And Robert Vaughn, his deal is that he's wealthy beyond imagination. He's one of the greatest assassins in the galaxy, but now everybody wants him dead. He's every planet has a high price on his head, and he can't go anywhere. And he's living on this terrible backwater planet that's with a poisonous atmosphere. It's run down. He's hiding. And as he says, I eat serpents 7 days a week.
He's got Greedo showing up every once in a while trying to knock him off.
Yeah, no, it is awful. And so
very inconvenient.
So essentially this offer of, a place to hide and a warm meal is worth putting his life on the line for. And so he ends up getting shot down towards the end of the movie. And he dies, and they have the burial scene. And there's this moment where he's like, bury him with
a seven-course meal.
With a seven-course meal, because that was our deal. But there's this moment when he's dying, when he's like, not this planet. Why here? Where you're just like, you feel really sad for the guy. Cause as much as they herald him as a hero, he's like, why did I die for these fucking people?
Yeah.
Why did I do this? This was a terrible
idea.
It's
a really dark and intriguing moment in a film that you would not expect something that heavy.
And so you feel conflicted because you realize exactly why Richard Thomas hasn't buried, why he does it. He's like keeping the deal, and he's like, no, that was the deal, and that's how we honor him. And then there's part of it that's kind of like, dude, that's kind of bleak, and I don't think he wants to spend all of eternity buried on this backwater planet he didn't give a shit about. That's like exactly the awful fate he was afraid of.
He doesn't want to be buried in the universe's equivalent of Canada.
Yeah.
That is what he doesn't want.
But then on top of it, the way he describes himself and who he is through the movie, he's kind of a fucking shitheel,
yeah.
And you shouldn't feel bad for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, like all tribute is due to John Sayles' script and just the things that he was able to do and the really interesting things he was able to weave in there. Like, again, I mentioned Asimov. There is a line in the movie where the ship basically takes over from Shad the hero because he's such an ineffectual little noodle at the beginning of the film. And they're in a battle in a dog fight, and the ship basically takes over and fires when he doesn't. And he says, he has this really weird line where he actually says, "That which is not organic must not harm that which is from, see, the planet Akir has this weird code called the Varda. And that feels very much like almost like a Bushido or some kind of, you know, Japanese sort of code of ethics. But then all of a sudden he's throwing in one of Asimov's laws of robotics.
His three laws of robotics. Yeah.
It's just a very – like that to me is the ultimate moment of confluence in the movie where it's like you're taking something from Akira Kurosawa and mixing it with something even deeper sci-fi than Star Wars. And again, Star Wars owes a lot of its existence to Hidden Fortress.
Yeah.
So there's just all kinds of this weird cyclical relationship between these two movies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that scene's particularly great because that shows us, you know, we have this one of those great examples of the snarky artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And the ship is just like, "Shad, I don't give a shit what you think. You know, you're not Zed the Corsair."
The ship calls the enemy sons of bitches. Yeah. I always love that. The ship is so foul-mouthed and has so much attitude. I love it.
For a kid's movie.
For a kid's movie.
I mean, yeah, no, it's...
I hate showing my backside to those sons of bitches. The ship says this in a woman's voice.
Oh, this movie's so good.
Monumentally good. Monumentally good. Yeah, but that scene in particular, the burial of Gelt is, yeah, it's moving, but it's also, like you said, it's very conflicting and you're not exactly sure how to think about it. There's a lot of things that end up, you know, speaking of it being a kid's movie, there's a lot of things in this movie that are very subversive in terms of sexuality as well. Like there's the scene where sort of the, our hero Shad meets this woman who is the daughter.
Saint X-Men.
No, not her.
Oh,
but,
no. Okay, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. So the daughter of Dr. Hephaestus, and essentially as soon as he meets her, Dr. Hephaestus wants them to get married. Just immediately, like, I'll help you, but you have to marry my daughter, which is
– No, he said, "I'm not going to help you. But I'm going to keep you here and you're going to need to go back for war.
Right.
Yeah, no, you're here now. You're stuck here."
So it was even more of an entrapment than, you know, making this deal. And so that's really weird. But then when she gets to the planet, when she gets to Akir, and by this point they have met Saint X-Men, apparently Professor X is a saint now. I don't know. The point is she and the daughter are having this conversation where the daughter says to her, I don't know what sex is. I've never had sex before. And Saint X-Men, who is sort of this Valkyrie from
From
Planet Valkyrie, who is like this female warrior, is just like, "Stick with me and I'll show you that." Like, it's like almost suggesting that the two of them are having a relationship. It's very bizarre. And then there's like lines in the movie, like where Shad is yelling at the ship to stop firing from the position they're in, and he just keeps saying over and over again, not from behind, no. And it was just like, what the fuck are you doing, Sales? What thoughts are you trying to implant in my very impressionable mind? You know, but
I'm not certain that's where he's going, but it's funny.
It's funny if he had said it once, I would have been like, well, that's just awkward. You know, that's unfortunate. But he kept screaming it to the point that I was like, what are you trying to tell me, Sales? What, you know, talk to me. What's happening right now?
Well, and Sales is one of those brilliant guys that puts subtext into everything. It's entirely possible that he's like, look, I've got to write this movie. So I'm going to talk about, you know, underneath this all, it's about the sexuality of a young man and a young man finding himself. And that thread is there, you know. He's confronted by Saint X-Men, who is, you know, this big-breasted Valkyrie played by
Sybil Danning.
Yeah, by Sybil Danning, who's just oozing sex and is dressed up in leather with her boobs pushed out and is just everything that she's pure Frazetta is what she is.
Right.
She's a Frazetta woman.
Absolutely.
And here he is with this sweet, nebbish, nerdy, you know, daughter of a scientist who says things like, "Do you have kissing on your planet?"
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Who's very kind of teenage and exploring herself and nervous and there, you know, he has that scene with St. X-Men, which when St. X-Men just fully comes on to him and after the fight, it's like, that was a great battle. And she all but says, you know what I like after a good battle. She says that in so many words.
It's not a stiff drink.
Yeah. And so he's like, oh, well, I'm just going to be quippy and get the hell out of here. You know,
yeah.
Hey, this parachute's not a knapsack. or this parachute's a knapsack. Yes, that was a Friends reference. Sorry about that for those of you offended by it. But then he has this very, you know, slowly developing relationship with a girl he was set up with. And that might be there. There might be those. I would not put it past Sales to put that in the undertones of this film. And now I'm going to go home and watch this film again, looking for the sexual undertones of Shad. Because you know what? That's the kind of night it is.
It is that kind of a night. But I mean, definitely overall, Battle Beyond the Stars, it may be a movie that you haven't heard about at all, or a film that you've heard about only in the sense that it's Seven Samurai in Space or it's Corman's Star Wars ripoff. You know, maybe you've heard about it in those reductive terms. And those things are certainly true, but there's so much more going on in this movie than you could possibly imagine looking at it from the outside. So really, really highly recommend it. Whether you like it because it's one of those films that it's a very 80s future. It's a very 80s galaxy. I mean, looking across the faces of Akir is like looking at a Jay Giles Band album insert. Like, it's so many mustaches and terrible perms. It's unbelievable.
The Greek clothing they got on.
Including leggings, yeah. Because it's the 80s. And you know, listen for, like, the Star Wars thing is absolutely undeniable. In fact, at one point, when they're on Dr. Hephaestus' ship, every time a door opens, it is the sound of Darth Vader breathing. No, not doesn't sound like Darth Vader breathing. It is like they went to – because, you know, like you mentioned, they hired people from ILM.
Yeah.
They got that sound effect somehow, and they use it every single time a door opens. That is not accidental.
No. It's Corman was very blatant about wanting this to be a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
And it's God, it is its own thing. No, I love it. I actually collect the posters, and I've got a number of the posters. And there's the Spanish poster. There's makes no bones about it. It's Los Seven Magníficos, and it's and it's like they just in Spain they just called it the Magnificent Seven in space. I mean, it's kind of awesome. It really is a special movie, and it's one of those movies that if you take our advice on this and you've never watched it and you sit down to watch it, you're going to be watching it going, what the hell is this? This is cheesy. It's stiff. But it will win you over. I mean, it will. It's just that movie. You know, it's interesting. For my birthday a few years ago, like, Tim League is super awesome, and you'll hear us talk about him a lot. He's the founder of the Alamo Drafthouse here in town. And for a bunch of the critics here in town, he gives us a theater on our birthday.
Yeah.
And, Friends of the Draft House, he's given,
he's done it for me a couple times.
Yeah. And so,
very sweet of him.
So he hands you the list. He has one of his assistants send you the list of the films that they've got in their vault and lets you show one. And a couple years ago, I found, he had Sorceress.
Yep.
And Sorceress, we'll talk about Sorceress in another episode, but Sorceress is a terrible film that you cannot find. That he butchered and was, you know, it was the last film of a long relationship with a lifelong friend who he butchered the film, ruined the relationship, ended the guy's career. But the interesting thing about that movie and the reason I wanted to watch it was he copy and pasted the entire soundtrack from Battle Beyond the Stars. He took James Horner's soundtrack and just stuck it on that movie, which is why it's impossible to find because of rights issues and because of an – I believe it has to do with an injunction Horner put out, but I'm not 100% on that. I can't get confirmation on that yet. You can't find it on DVD. It was on VHS shortly in the 80s, but – there's this print, and sure enough, it's just the music doesn't even fit in most scenes, but there it is, pasted on. And even then, in this bad, hilariously awful movie, that is just delightfully terrible in all the right and worst ways. I'm hearing that music and it's swelling and I'm just getting all excited and like, yeah, because that music just connects with me now. That movie is a part of my DNA. I saw it in a theater when I was 6 years old and watched it on cable a number of times and then on video. And I would, when I was a video store clerk on particularly bad days, I would have, I'd have my trilogy and I would watch Battle Beyond the Stars, Krull, and Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. So that my entire day was filled with this triumphant James Horner score and yeah. in these great adventurous movies. And it's hard to have a bad day when that's on in the background. And this movie, man, I if you have not seen it, you owe it to yourself to check this out. It's, you know, this is what got Cameron ended up meeting Galen Hurd on that set. They fell in love. They got married. He ended up working for a week on Piranha 2 after that. And getting fired.
Spawning.
Getting fired because he was, you know, already over budget on week one. But then he and Galen Hurd went off together and said, fuck this. We know how to do this now. We're going to raise the money and make our little science fiction film called The Terminator. And the rest is history. And, yeah. and both of them went on to amazing things. James Horner would work with James Cameron again on films like Aliens and Titanic and The Abyss. I believe Horner did the score for The Abyss.
I know for sure Titanic and Aliens.
Yeah. And then John Sayles would go on to, write a couple more films for Corman. And then go on to make his own, write and direct his own little film called Brother from Another Planet. And then he started doing much more serious films and did Eight Man Out and Matawan and Men with Guns and the brilliant Lone Star, which I think is the shining star, if you'll pardon the pun.
Always pardon puns.
Of his career. I mean, it really is it is the highlight of his career. As much as I love Battle Beyond the Stars, his best film by far is Lone Star. But all of these people went on to do just such amazing things. And then of course, you know, we saw a resurgence in the '80s with Robert Vaughn and George Peppard. And so they went on to do cool stuff. And it's just a film that needs to be a part of your DNA as well. It's just a special, special movie.
Definitely. And for your edification, I have here some facts about Astronaut Ice Cream. Did you know Astronaut Ice Cream, alias freeze-dried ice cream, was developed by Whirlpool, the appliance conglomerate? And despite its name, only one NASA mission carried with it a batch of freeze-dried ice cream. Cargo, do you care to venture a guess which space or which NASA mission?
Apollo 11.
It was actually Apollo 7 in 1968. And despite the fact that it was developed at the request of the astronauts, it ended up being not that popular. And regular ice cream has actually been consumed more than astronaut ice cream in Space Shuttle, Skylab, and the International Space Station. So why do I bring up so much superfluous information about astronaut ice cream?
I was just wondering that myself.
Because I didn't tell you I was going to do this.
No, you did not.
Because I feel that this is the perfect junk food companion to Battle Beyond the Stars. It takes something familiar and gives it a sci-fi twist. It takes ice cream and basically freeze-dries it and tells you and sells it to you as this is something astronauts eat, even though they really didn't. Much in the same way that Corman took The Seven Samurai, a familiar story, and gave it an intergalactic conceptual bent. So if you will excuse us, we are going to go procure some astronaut ice cream. They still sell that, right? That's a thing that still exists.
I have no idea.
We're gonna go find it.
You know, the astronaut ice cream is, hey, do you like ice cream? Yeah. Well, let's take half of it out. You'll love it. Well, that's our inaugural episode of Junk Food Cinema.
We did it!
We did it. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you're looking forward now that we've made our thesis statement of what this is about. We hope you have fun listening to us talk about movies. My name is C. Robert Cargill. You can find me online on Twitter at Massaworm. MASSAWYRM or follow me on Facebook at facebook.com/CRobertCargill. You can find my book Dreams and Shadows wherever you buy your books or my film Sinister wherever you like to watch movies.
Wherever being your home now. I mean, it might still be in a couple theaters, like in Des Moines.
No. I know it's on, it is currently, at the moment, currently on cable. It's on Showtime, but you can pick it up through Amazon. You can pick it up at, if you go to a video store, I'm sure they may have it. It did decently well, so it did all right.
So it'll be available. It'll be available.
It's around.
Right on. Well, yeah, this is Brian Salisbury, and you can find me, you can also find me over at One of Us Net, which is a site that I run with Christopher Lawrence Cox. We have a lot of podcasts and articles over there. You can find me on Twitter personally at BryGuySalisbury, or you can follow this show at Junk Food Cinema. And you can also, if you want to go back on Film School Rejects here and read Junk Food Cinema, the paper version, the digital paper version. Yeah. To prep yourself for future episodes, that would probably not be a bad idea. But Cargo, thank you so much for agreeing to be the co-host of this weird experiment.
I hope we don't want to throttle each other to death at some point. And I hope it all works out. But no, I'm really excited. I'm really happy that I can get back to doing this. I've really missed doing podcasting. I really miss talking about movies. I just couldn't find a way to do it and make it work. And this does.
And here we are. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll be here every week. Until next time, Junk Food Cinema, the leading cause of cerebral obesity. Good night.